If being an artist were simply having beautiful thoughts, I would be one of the top 10 in the history of Western art, at least, and possibly of all art from the cave paintings to our present time. I'm very serious about that. That's not funny. I've got some of the most incredible thoughts. I mean, sometimes my thoughts are so beautiful they wake me up, you know, and after a big lasagna meal, that's about all that will. It's just amazing, my thoughts. They are extravagant. They are gorgeous. Oh, they are so wonderful. But by the time they get out through my skinny wrist onto canvas or carved in wood, they have nothing whatsoever to do with what I started out with. Not only are they a sign of my failure, but they won't go away. Some of them are in walls of churches. And I got married in front of one of my first murals. And my father, who performed one part of the service, and my bride's father, who performed the other, double knot, we're inseparable, they were concerned about me during the whole wedding service because I just sat there shaking my head back and forth. I was looking at that awful thing on the wall. Had nothing to do with the wedding. How could you do a dumb thing like that? They were preaching and going through the whole ceremony. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, and you call yourself an artist. So the book is kind of like that. I read it, and I listen to these tapes they make of me, and I say, you know, if I were out there listening to him, I'd walk out. There she goes. You sure didn't need much encouragement. I know. That's a fact. It's a fact. It's like what we were doing yesterday. God bless you. We had such a good time yesterday afternoon practicing for the Vespers last night. And I had the hardest time trying to tell him that all that rehearsal was just, you know, forget it. Because once the lights go out and you start pushing the buttons, it's not going to be like anything we have done. You're not going to be able to, ooh, number 3. And that looked really good with number, where's number 12? Oh, I can't find number 12. You can't. You just push the buttons and see what happens together. And in rehearsal, we were looking at combinations and saying, oh, is that wonderful? Is that really good? That's going to really be nice tonight. And I said, oh, forget it. It's not going to be that. What you just saw is now gone. Gone. And that's why when we talk about art, we talk about the process. Art isn't what you got. That's not art. Some of you knew that already, but... But seriously, folks, can we talk? That is not art. That is what you've got left after art has taken place. You understand what I'm saying? Art was the doing of it. That you walk in and into a building and it's called an art museum would only be legitimate if there were people around painting. And there never are. There are all of these dead things in frames hanging on the wall with little things underneath bragging on the part of the museum. This one's worth $3 million. This one's worth $4 million. And the artist never got squat. He got nada. And it didn't matter because he was doing the art. You can't come up to something and say, and make it no art. It's too late. It's already art. Sorry, folks. Don't care what you say, it's too late. Art is always in process, always. As soon as it stops, you have, you know, like cut the umbilical cord, patted the little piece on its fanny and sent it out into the public. It is art object. An art object and art are two different things. Two different things. And it's very important for you to know that the doing is worth the doing, not what you've got left after you're done. And that runs smack contrary to the main operating motif of our time, which is the bottom line. Art is anti-bottom line. You don't go to an artist and say, you know, just don't tell me how you're going to do it. Just tell me how much is it going to cost and when will it be done. He can't tell you. He can't. That is the job of the salesman. The artist will just simply do it. And you'll have to wait. But after it's done, it's the art is done too. In other words, you cannot buy art. You gotta love that. You can only buy leftovers, folks. Leftovers. And you can warm them up with your own imagination. That is the second life of art. It's when you come to a thing. You can't go to a Rembrandt painting of his mother and say, that, I'm sure, is not what his mother looked like. It doesn't matter. You can't go to Van Gogh's painting of his shoes and say, did he really wear those things? It doesn't matter. Somehow you got to take what we give you and remake it in your own image. Not just say, ooh, that reminds me of a pair of shoes I used to wear. That's not creativity. That's sentimentality. You got to take and continue it the next step. Make something out of it so that it doesn't stand still. As soon as it stands still, it's something else, but not art. Okay? I don't know why I said that. Because it has nothing to do with the subject that we're supposed to be talking about. Well, yeah, maybe it does. Which is art, faith, and foolishness. The way it is. How many of you were with us on the way it was? Okay, some of you were with us on the way it was. And that was history from the very beginning up until Gothic Age. I don't think I quite made it into the Gothic. We sort of pooped out at Gisobertus. But I want to show you some contemporary church art, contemporary churches, and worship spaces, and see if we can't continue the problem of the relationship of foolishness. And somehow, in the 20th century, foolishness is not so much risk-taking as it is huh, showing off. That's maybe an indictment already, and maybe you should decide whether it's showing off or not. But for me, I have real trouble with the 20th century and churches. First of all, they're boring. And the reason why they're boring is because in our time there is nothing we can't make. I am one dinky little designer. I am not even an architect. And we have built a church under the water off the coast of France, 400 feet under the water, a church where they worship, a community farming the ocean floor goes to church in this little bubble we designed. And it's down there and it's being used. We have designed a church made out of air that hovers around the hillsides outside of Kalamazoo, Michigan. Air walls, completely air conditioned. They worshiped in there in the winter and were surprised during a hailstorm to see little balls come down and just make a right-hand turn in midair. Woo! Far out. Whoa. Look at them little balls. Really screwed up the liturgy that morning, watching them little balls come down out of the sky and bounce off of air. And we have just had our designs accepted by the NASA Space Agency for a chapel to be built on the moon. There is nothing, nothing we can make. So why are we making these boring buildings? We get the lights.
Yeah.
Does that go on? Yay. The Baroque Age. You'd walk up to a church, lily white and simple in a field, and you'd listen to Mozart. That last time I went to this church, the Wieskirche, very close to Oberammergau, those of you that have been to the Passion Play, out in a meadow. Big church, very simple on the outside, and the last time I was there, I heard Mozart coming through the windows, and I went in and right in the middle of a beautiful Mozart chamber concert. And it wasn't just the music that got me kind of giddy. It was the building. Heavenly days. Like my Aunt Pauline's attic. Check out the pulpit. Can you make the pulpit out over there? Up just to the right of the chancel. Oh, I wonder how many Lutheran pastors would like a pulpit like that. Unfortunately, probably quite a few. But the problem with the Baroque was that it was incredibly excessive. Oh my goodness, it just, there was just two of everything and three of most. And it was really, I think, partly propagandistic. They were trying to convince people to come into the church after the Protestant Reformation. And so they built their churches as though heaven opened up and came right through their ceilings, right out onto the ground. Ecstasy was the operative word for the Baroque Age. So when the 20th century came along, architects were really struggling and fighting against the excesses of the Baroque. And one has to wonder whether there wasn't a bit of overkill. The liturgical renewal emphasized the actions of the people. Beautiful. But in the process of clearing out all of the debris and the excesses of the Baroque, they got, I think, quite self-consciously clinical. While the Baroque covered up an awful lot of architecture so that you couldn't tell where the walls ended and the sculpture began, The liturgical renewal called for honesty in architecture, and it became so honest that the architects were afraid to put anything on it or in it. And this is a beautiful building. It's incredibly subtle. If you look at the wings of cement floating up in the air on those slender columns, it's really quite sensitive. And yet we can be just as self-conscious worshiping in a pile of manure as we can in a grandiose cathedral. The focus in the Baroque may be the excesses. The focus in the liturgical renewal buildings may be the emptiness. In either case, the body of Christ is losing in the translation. As a church, and if the congregation goes belly up, we can use it for a dirigible hangar. I'm not sure whether this congregation is trying to impress the city of Milan with its walls or not, but this thing, at least I have to believe, was built before aerosol cans were invented. This thing is just asking to be writ on. I'm sorry, I get carried away here, but there is a moat around this church, folks. There's a little glass bridge that goes over a moat. Kind of Missouri Synod, maybe, or, you know, maybe you have to check in. I'm Missouri Synod. And this one could probably be used as a Nike silo or something. It's a frightening building. The iconography of brick. And if you're not sure that it looks like a church, just stick a cross out in front. Looks like they stuck it right in the middle of the basketball court. This is kind of rude as far as being able to speak. I consider church architecture, even on the outside, to be a part of a congregation's evangelism program. I consider the way the lawn is mowed to be part of the church's mission program. It will say something. You don't have to understand architecture to get an impression from this building. Every time I go to Cologne, Germany, to this particular, and I go about twice a year, I expect this church to have had babies. Every time I see it, it just looks pregnant to me, and I expect to see little ones up and down the block the next time I go. This is a very interesting church, and I don't know if it's a theology of baptism or what, but what are those downspouts doing right over the door? That's marvelous. It's born again. You know what I want for this church? I want little ponies, wooden ones, in liturgical colors, going up and down. At least give the neighborhood something to talk about instead of trying to figure out which one of those doors is the one that gets you in. This is interesting. This is not a cross. This is the street sign, people. That's the cross. I mean, they got a cross, but You try and find your way into this thing, you run around the back, but that's no help. Almost all of these churches that I've showed you as unusual, as silly, as stark as they are based on some historical model. All of them. They're either Gothic or Romanesque or Byzantine. They depend on some historical model. This is the chapel at Valparaiso University, and this depends upon a historical model. The model of the crypt, the underground crypt. So there is a large raised platform at the end under that star roof. That's the chancel. That fancy glass part, that is for the chancel prancers. The rest of us get this brick part in the back. So we got two churches hooked together here. The little silo at this end is the baptistry. And you go down into it. It's really quite effective. But it is long, long and narrow. And the chancel steps are 11 feet up. I mean, you got to climb 11 steps to get to communion. Who wanted to see this? Are you here? All right. Grundtvig's church in Copenhagen, 7 million bricks, and I don't know what story you got, but I was told that it was three bricklayers that did the whole thing. Grundtvig wrote many, many, 200 hymns, I think, many of them in the Lutheran hymnal, and so his church kind of looks like a big organ. But it's a Gothic building. No matter what the skin, it's still essentially Gothic. I thought you'd like to see the inside of it. The brick continues all around the inside. It's amazing. And a great, huge model of a ship. The King of Denmark always gives a ship to a new church being dedicated in Denmark. Hyperbolic paraboloids. In Tokyo, also in San Francisco. Some of you may have seen the cathedral in San Francisco, designed by the same architect that did this one in Tokyo. Air Force Academy Chapel? It's Gothic. It is flat out Gothic. The same idea that it all points to the sky while everything around it huddles close to the ground. The thing is covered in stainless steel. It's a kind of a tricky material because it expands and contracts. And you know Colorado Springs can get awful cold at night and awful warm the next morning. And you can sit there on a Sunday morning, on a hot Sunday morning after a cold Saturday night, and that whole thing sounds like a popcorn popper. The shell of the building just groaning. Romanesque, enclosed, fortress, Festubourg. This is Collegeville, St. John's Abbey. Ooh, would I love a roller? Would I just love to get my hands on a roller? It wouldn't take me 5 minutes and I could make a statement on the outside of this wall. I think I'd do a great big long from top to bottom exclamation mark. Just, you know. This is a church for those of you that need the time of day. The funny thing about the planning of this, it looks kind of like a mall, but that's all church. And the really bizarre thing is that those little slits under the bells are church offices. Can you imagine noon? You're sitting at your desk counseling somebody. I imagine at about 5 of noon, all of the people just make a mad dash out of the offices. I've said it before, and it bears repeating, there is no text without context. You have to understand the nature of these things before you can really understand why they are done. So it isn't appropriate, as I am doing now, to take pot shots at churches without really knowing why they were done the way they were done. And you can look at this church and say, my goodness, that's a little bit cold, mechanical. I worshiped in this church, and it is one of the most moving buildings I have ever been in my life. It is just an incredibly dramatic thing. This is in Saarbrücken. Saarbrücken is the capital of the coal mining area of Alsace, on the French and German border. And the last time I was there was on the occasion of the funeral of 52 coal miners. 52 died in an explosion in the mine. Every member unit of this congregation is affiliated with the mine. And this architecture duplicates the gantry, the entrance into the mine. It is exactly the same facility that these people have to enter when they go down into the mines. And in this church, up in that top pyramid, is a huge, huge wheel with ropes coming down. And the ropes hold up the chancel platform. The first time I was in this church and the pastor walks up on this platform, I thought the whole thing was going to go down. The last time, the altar was taken off, all 52 coffins were set on the chancel, and the Eucharist was celebrated on top of the coffins. And it was one of the most dramatic, dynamic services I have ever been at. And I felt at the time that we were down in the mine and that we were on the verge of being lifted up. It was a beautiful thing. But the architecture relates to their people. And that's what liturgy has to do. Worship is not the time of the week in which you escape from the world. Worship is that time in which you take the world and redeem it and get prepared to go back out again. Believe it or not, this is in Holland. I would like just one dinky little tulip somewhere in there, not a bush. But this is called the Ark Church. When you drive by on the outside, you're rather unimpressed. But the way the building is designed is very much like how they intend to use it. The curvy slope is over the worship area. The slope down is over the baptistry. The flat slope is all the way around that unit, and it is the Gemeindehaus. It is the house of the church in community. And they have daycare center in there, diaconate offices, family planning, youth counseling, all kinds of facilities for the community to use. And on Sunday morning, it's their narthex. It wraps around the entire facility. I won't design a new church unless the narthex is as large as the worship area. And that sounds incredibly extravagant, but it is one of the best uses of a congregation's funds I can think of, at least as large. Here's a narthex on the outside. This is in a city in Switzerland, in Biersfelden, and Bruder Klauskirche has an inside narthex, which is rather small, and an outside one, which is large. And every afternoon they have brown bag concerts out there. People just sit around and listen to musicians. I attended a performance of Everyman on the chancel. They block off the streets, and everybody sits around in the street and watches the performance. On Sunday morning, it's really cute. They have a clown ministry. I have some problems with clown ministries personally, and I really need to loosen up a little in regard to that. But I saw something there that I really loved. A lady was making a phone call in the street, at the payphone across the street, and a clown came out, went over to her, and got her and brought her into church. She didn't want to go. I hope she benefited. But if it hadn't been a clown, you know, the guy probably would have got punched out. Something on the outside, anything at all on the outside, I would just love to see the church look like it's interested in celebrating its hope with strangers. But if you look at most churches, all the goodies are directed towards the people that are in there, that are inside. And of course, they're the people that need them the least. They've got the hope. They've got the message. That's why they're in there. Strangers passing by that have senses of desperation or frustration or just no senses at all need to be perked up, need to have their imaginations boosted, need to have the day celebrated with them. But the church does very little to direct its attention outward. I don't know what that means. All I know is that the church is sharing its creativity with me, and I'm not even a member. And I really like that, and it makes me want to go in and find out more. You can get in trouble. This is a church in Wichita Falls, and we put the creed on the outside, and the guy across the lawn about where I took the picture sued the church. He sued. First of all, he wasn't a member. He didn't want to look at their creed. And there was an ordinance in Wichita Falls that said you're not allowed to post signs on public walls. And so he said, take it off. I don't want to look at it while I'm washing dishes. And took him to court. The pastor called me. We put this thing up in 110 degree temperature in Texas. It was awful. And he says, I know how much work you put into this, Rich, but it's going to have to come down. I said, okay. He says, it's not okay. Talk to me. I said, what would you like to know? And he says, I have no idea. It's just I'd like to keep it. So I described to him the process of doing a sgraffito, how you lay down one layer of colored plaster on top of another, depending on how many colors you want, and then you scratch down to the color you want. And he said, thanks, I'll call you back. And Tuesday after the trial preliminaries, he called me back. He says, I'd just like you to know that we got to keep the wall. I said, well, that's good. Why? What was the thing that did it? Well, he said, it was the process. That isn't on the wall. It is the wall. You can't take it off without removing the wall. So the old guy moved. And that's sad. That's sad. Somehow we should have gotten closer to him in the process of all of this. You also got to be a little careful. This is a church in Germany, and I drove around this thing, I don't know, four or five times. I heard they had good stained glass, but I thought this building was a clinic. That's a perfectly good symbol for a church, but it's also a perfectly good symbol for a clinic, for a medical facility. So you got to be a little careful about your symbols. Can, as I've said, tend to focus on their own architecture rather than on the reason for being.
As I go about designing church spaces, I am amazed at how few good Christian people can tell you why they go to church. What's there that they can't get at home? They'll tell you, well, we go to hear the sermon. Well, you can get that at home. You can stay in bed and dial the church of your choice. Why do you go? What is there for you? An awful lot of our architecture suggests that you go in order to look at the building. Some architecture suggests you go to be engulfed or wrapped or staring at the walls. This is Our Lady of the Hymn Board. There is an altar and a baptismal font in this picture, but you wouldn't know it because the hymn board is really quite dominant. I think of this I refer to this architecture as 20th century American penal. Beautiful masonry. Incredible. Just really good. But that whole space, this whole space from here to the back wall and all the way across is for one person. Just for one. And when it comes time for communion, that poor sucker's got to run back and forth down to this rail, back up for refills, back down the steps, back and forth, up and down. And he can't get any help. I mean, would you help this guy? Stand alongside that altar? One step back and you're dead. It's ridiculous. That whole space for one person. And the liturgical renewal is supposed to be about the priesthood of all believers. So it isn't excellence. This is excellence. But excellence is not enough when we build churches. We also have to be appropriate. That choir gets... choirs I have more trouble with than anything. And you know, I mean, they're important and absolutely necessary. I just can't figure out where to put them. They decided here that they would put them in the chancel and have them face the opposite wall. So they sing to the wall, and I'm sure the wall answers back, but I have no idea whether any of that sound is going to get down into where the people are. We have still... in the Lutheran Church and in, you know, I think it's general, a kind of fetish with the east wall, the chancel wall. We just dump on that wall. We hang crosses on it. We doll it up. We hang murals. We hang banners. Anything we can get to give us the emphasis that the emphasis of the east wall as the focus for our worship. And the east wall is not the focus of our worship. No walls are the focus of our worship. We are the focus of our worship around word and sacrament. Which means if you really want to build a Christian church, you got to build it so that the emphasis is on people, not on walls. That's that 11 steps up to the chancel. The worst place, and this is going to probably cancel out half your churches. I love to cancel out churches. The worst place for stained glass windows is in the chancel. Absolutely the worst. The main reason being that stained glass windows are so pretty. And pretty has nothing to do with worship. You can't worship and focus on stained glass windows. what's more, light coming in through a stained glass window messes up your rods and cones so bad, your little eyeballs just start jumping around, and everything that goes on in front of a stained glass window turns into silhouette, flattens out, dehumanizes. And that's not what we want in worship. We're better off having them on the side. But that east wall fetish, we got to have it. I love this. This is in Hawaii. I'm doing a number of churches now in Hawaii. It's kind of a nice tour of duty, you know, and doing one on the black beach of the big island. And this is a little church. The pastor thought, the priest says it's too small. It's just too little, so he wanted to make it look bigger. And so he painted an extension on the wall. The church is just as small as it ever was, but it just looks bigger now. I think that's funny. Boy, is that ugly, but is that funny? And I think for me, funny is better than ugly, so I think funny wins. I'd worship in here and probably have a good time. I love those angels flying around up there. And those strange candelabra. Really strange. But this church goes on forever. Tremendous. It's longer than St. Peter's in Rome. The guy who put the lights in was probably a musician. You can sit in this church and sing the light fixtures. You could raise them up and down and play anything you want, you know. Oh, this is marvelous. Celebrated Mass in this church in Switzerland. Great idea. Extended the outside and kind of brought the outside into the church, but not quite enough. At high mass, with the elevation of the host, a little lady comes out of that window and shakes a yellow rug. Shook dust all over his wafer. I mean, just... And of course, the problem is the priest is facing the people. He doesn't... Everybody is sitting. She's going walking back and forth, and we are sitting there, oh, no, no. And the mass is getting more and more, you know, it's building up to a climax, and all of a sudden she comes out, you know, and people... In the highest part of the Mass, everybody in the congregation is going... And the poor priest is standing there. Did I do something wrong? The poor... We all were very apologetic after the service. And told him what was happening, and he was a good sport, and he said, I got to get to her and see if she'll do it in liturgical colors. I'm going to let you stretch, people, before our Vespers. Tomorrow morning, what I want to do is show you some of the ways that congregations can work on the inside of their facilities in order to give them meaning and in order to participate themselves in that meaning. Not to go shopping from place to place and just order your stuff and bring it in, but to know what you need, to celebrate what you know, and to take part in the process of making your own house of worship. God bless.